Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
The pastures in the wilderness shout for joy, says Psalm 65 in the Bible. But today the forests must bemoan their losses. This week on The Spirit of Things, The Greening of the Church, I'm Rachel Kahn and you're tuned to ABC Radio National. In the lead-up to the election, the environment has become a key political issue, whether it's water management or old-growth forests, nuclear power or car pollution. They're all hot issues, but they're not new ones.
Save the day tree! More money for buybacks! Save the day tree! More money for buybacks!
Standard mills to the devil! Choke on your sawdust, you're not on the level. Save our forest forever!
You told me I was charged with destruction by whom?
Confrontations at the Daintree and then at Terania Creek near Lismore in northern New South Wales in 1979, which started the green activist ball rolling. What's changed in our day is that environmental awareness is becoming a religious issue and that churches are becoming proactive. They're electing to adopt a green mandate, which requires them to be morally responsible for the environment. Today we'll hear from a very green Uniting Church in Sydney's Maroubra Junction, where the minister Peter Hobson talks about Project Green Church, with two other principal spokesmen, Geoffrey Callaghan and Miriam Pepper. But practical measures aren't the whole story. In Adelaide, the Australasian Theological Forum held a conference recently on religion and science, which I'll be bringing to you in the near future. One of the presenters I met there is Jason Johns, the first eco-minister of the Uniting Church. Between workshops, I managed to find a not-so-quiet room at the Australian College of Divinity in Adelaide. Jason, how did you become an eco-minister, and are you the only one in Australia? I've actually never heard of that title.
I think I'm the only one, certainly the only one in Australia who's ordained and has a full-time stipend to do eco-ministry. There are a few retired people that are able to use their time to do eco-ministry around the churches, but yes, as far as I know, I'm the only one that's actually been placed by a church to do it as a minister.
And what are your credentials in this?
Well, I guess my childhood love of animals became a zoology degree at Adelaide University, and I went on to do honours there, then became a Christian and wondered what that meant for my life. Ended up candidating as a deacon in the Uniting Church, and as part of that was able to do environmental studies because it was a very new ministry and people weren't sure how to train people for it. But my hope was that as deacons were meant to work for justice for the marginalised, I would be able to concentrate on all of the non-human marginalised creatures in creation. So after graduating and being a chaplain for a while and working as an environment officer, I came back to Adelaide and did my PhD with Andrew Jutney, which was really a chance to bring my scientific thinking and my new faith experiences together. So my PhD was on mostly evolutionary biology and its implication for Christian faith.
Have you had any mentors in the field? I think of Matthew Fox and creation spirituality. He was one of the proponents of that. Are you inspired by any theologian who's gone down this path?
Yes, Matthew Fox's work I haven't read much of. And I guess because my main interest was in evolution, I was surprised to discover how small a field of theologians there were that had really spent a lot of time engaging with it. But there was Arthur Peacock and Polkinghorne, whose last name I forget at the moment.
John Polkinghorne.
John Polkinghorne. Dennis Edwards is here coming from a Catholic perspective. Probably at around the time I was leaving for Queensland, there was a real focus down here in the Adelaide College of Divinity. The Earth Bible Project was also happening, but within evolution and theology that was quite profound as well. I guess Andrew Jutney was a mentor in the more general sense of someone who took the insights from the sciences and wider thinking and tried to understand their faith better through that. The Uniting Church said from its beginnings that we would come to understand God and ourselves better through contact with contemporary thought. So I saw my PhD as fitting very squarely within the Uniting Church project. But specifically, my mentors have been more people in books than people I've got to meet face to face yet.
How challenging are the stories that science tells us about our world to the faithful believer, the Christian or the Bible believer?
A lot of my experience in Queensland Uni was coming across students who'd grown up in very conservative churches and then had started Biology 1 and had a massive faith crisis and kind of fallen apart. And it seemed to me really unfortunate that that was the case, having started with biology, I guess, and then hitting Christianity. So for some people, it's a major threat. For other people, it's probably not threatening enough, and I met plenty of Christians who said that they believed evolution was probably true, they weren't really sure and they didn't see that it really mattered. Generally, a lot of Australian Christians, for example, would say they accept evolution, but we haven't really done very much thinking about what the implications of evolution are for the Christian story, which I think are absolutely massive.
Well, indeed, I'd like you to tell me how you think scientific revelations about evolution and about the cosmos and about life in general has an impact on some pretty basic religious concepts.
Sure. I guess humans, like any species, tend to see themselves as the centre of things, and certainly within the Christian tradition, human beings are often the centre of the story between God and life. We have tended to assume that we've been here the whole time. So in a literal approach to Genesis, there were only 5 days when humans didn't exist, and after that God put us in charge. We were created in God's image, unlike any other creature, and the Catholic Church in particular continues to affirm that there's a complete discontinuity between humans and other animals spiritually. Protestant churches probably would, but we don't have a single spokesperson. Even without evolution, we now know that the human history is a tiny flash in the pan of the history of life on Earth. And if there are more suns in the universe than there are grains of sand on every beach and desert on our planet, then the story of Earth is an unimaginably small part of the story of God and life in the universe, I would say.
Didn't you say earlier today that, in fact, the grains of sand represent only about a tenth of the number of stars there are?
Yes, that was a very rough guess in the early 2000s by some Australian scientists who'd just looked at one tiny field using some of the new Hubble images and then extrapolated from that. And their guess was, yes, there's a tenth as many grains of sand on every beach and desert on our planet as there are suns in the visible universe.
Amazing. Incomprehensible. So how does one turn these massive notions, the scale that is way beyond our comprehension, at least certainly beyond mine, how does one turn those stories that come to us from science into something that makes sense to us humans, us tiny specks in the universe?
That's a good question, which kind of working out myself. I guess on the one hand, the Judeo-Christian tradition has always said that God is great. Compared to God, we're quite small. We now understand how many more orders of magnitude that's true by. And personally, I just don't understand people who find that diminishing or fatalistic or would then come to the conclusion of, well, what's the point if we're a tiny speck? To me, that's kind of irrelevant. Like, I still have my one life to live, and if God's relating to other creatures all over the universe, that's great, but I'm never going to know about it, so it's still really my life to live. In terms of the Earth, I guess people have, some Christians think that if the Earth's going to be either burnt up by God or destroyed by the sun, then why bother caring for it now? And I guess my answer is that we all know we're going to die and our bodies are going to fall apart, but we would consider someone who therefore said, well, I won't bother looking after it, I'll eat and drink and let it fall apart, kind of mentally ill. So I think it increases the sense of awe and wonder. And as I said earlier today, I think our kind of highfalutin notions that we might be the stewards of this planet or the ones put here to look after it or control it, we can no longer hold to. Be that as it may, we are still called to love and revere life and life around us and the God behind it all in a way that possibly no other species on the planet can at the moment. It's still a very encouraging and inspiring calling.
Reverend Jason, how do you then explain to a young person, or an older person in fact, probably has more problems or more issues with this, all this new eco faith than young people do, how would you explain the notion that we are made in the image of God?
Yeah, I think the idea of the image of God isn't talked about in the scriptures much, but it's become very important to us, and it basically says that we are like God in a way that no other creature is, and that we therefore have a responsibility or a role on earth that no other creature has, and that in Genesis 1 is to tread down life and dominate and control it, and in Genesis 2 is to serve and protect it. I'd certainly rather people pick the second one, but I think even, I mean, ecologists now tell us that bacteria and plants run the show here. We're a very late arrival. If we went extinct, life would continue more or less as it always had. But to me, again, that's a positive thing to say. Well, if we are connected to all of life in the ways that scientists have now showed us genetically and evolutionary or so on, then it makes more sense to say that all of life is the image of God, because we know that all of life is involved in running the show, which relieves us of a huge burden of responsibility on the one hand, and also then means that if we want to engage with God, we no longer do that through the single species Homo sapien. We realise that it's through the whole world that we can do that.
How much do you allow science to sort of dictate your new eco-faith? For example, I think of some of the issues that have recently been published. Australasian Science had a cover story on the homosexuality of animals. So in a case like that, how does it affect issues of faith?
I hope I'm remembering right that Ted Peters, who is also here today, is one of the people that talks about religion being kind of consonant with science. So it's not completely derived from science or controlled by it, but what we say religiously ought to be not contradictory, or at least if it is, we ought to know it is and accept that. Like, on the one hand, I think arguing that because something happens in nature, it's the way we ought to do it, it makes no sense. That's a long bow to draw. But certainly in the issue of sexuality, we can say the church has made claims about sexuality based pretty much on the Genesis approach to things being given and designed by God the way they are, which assumes a particular approach to marriage, a particular approach to sexual preferences and relationships, we now know not to be true. So I find the Christian marriage services, we have it even in the Uniting Church, which talks about, you know, God giving marriage, we'd really need to do a lot of thinking about what that means. We know that there was no sex or gender when life started on earth. Then we had sex. Gender evolved considerably later. Since then, there have been an unimaginable array of ways of creatures getting together to reproduce and raise their young. We know that's true in human cultures as well. And so we kind of have this amnesia which assumes in the West that Western lifelong monogamy is the way it should be and always has been and the way God put it. Even if we just open our Bibles, we'll see that polygamy had a pretty good look in for a while. And as we go back through the rest of our history, we see that relationships and sexuality and child rearing are adaptations to our environment. And that doesn't mean the way we're doing it now is wrong, but it means that it's an adaptation to our environment. And I guess divorce rates and the stress that parents have in these new nuclear families that we've designed for ourselves suggests that maybe we haven't come up with the best answer yet.
Well, tell me about your eco ministry, because you have actually run particular worship services that have reflected this new way of incorporating science into faith. Can you tell me about how it all started and is it still going?
Sure. It is still going. It's a fairly small part of what I do time-wise at Scots Church at the moment. But basically in late 2005, I'd had the idea of, you know, what would you actually want to say about, or what would I want to say about God if I, you know, was at a church, and would anyone else be interested? And thought that maybe by around this time I might kind of look at that. Then I met Judith Haynes, who was doing her PhD on the Wilderness Society's members and their spirituality. She said, I'll just try it. So we decided to try a six-week course with my kind of reflection group at Scott's. We met out in the park, surrounded by life as much as we could, to kind of engage with the God of life and get away from the human building. And we looked at the story of evolution, then the idea of life being the image of God, of life having dominion on earth. Looked at the whole idea of the fall, because obviously Christian tradition has mostly said that humans ruined God's perfect planet, and that through human action, pain and death and all that horrible stuff came into the world, whereas we now know that actually pain and death are part of the process of evolution through which we formed. And that would be an example of before, where I said some people say they believe in evolution, but it doesn't really matter much to them. I mean, that's two completely different ways of looking at the world. And then the notion of original sin, and looking instead at really what are the inherent or original needs that we have as humans and as mammals, which we need to try and meet. And then the last week, the invitation was for people who'd come along to reflect on what all of that meant about our stories and our understanding about Jesus and the way they would tell their faith story from then on. Out of that, enough people wanted to keep meeting last year that we continued through 2006, probably only 8 to 12 of us out of a pool of 20 or so. And this year that's suddenly jumped to usually probably about 18. It's seen in the wider Uniting Church as something very exciting and promising and interesting. And certainly more people than myself are hopeful that I'll get funding to continue to minister with that community, as well as engage and resource kind of the wider church and really anyone that's interested.
Sounds fascinating. How much of the traditional worship service do you incorporate in it?
That waxes and wanes a bit. In 2005, I really tried to keep a lot of traditional components. So we had a call to worship and an opening prayer and things. Although it was also sitting in a circle with a lot of personal reflection and discussion, and because we were outdoors, we went off for our own 10-minute contemplative wandering walk and brought back anything we'd found that was interesting to talk about. Now we kind of start by engaging with our bodies, and we have a few people in the group that practice yoga, one of whom teaches it. So Beverly gets us engaged with our bodies and leaving behind the thoughts of the week or anything we don't need to be there. We do have prayers, but we keep them kind of as open as possible, I guess, because the purpose of our community is for people to come and engage with the God of life and to really think about what that means for themselves and their own understanding of God. Almost everyone there is Christian, and that is the context within which we work, although we have other people that come and go at times as well. But obviously, because within Christianity there's such a broad range of theologies about who Jesus was exactly and the meaning of prayer and things like that, we discuss those kind of things, and that happens a lot. But in terms of the actual worship, we try not to direct people too much as to what they should be praying for or the way they should be praying.
That was the Reverend Jason Johns of Scots Church in Adelaide, who's part of the new wave of the Uniting Church, experimenting with new forms of prayer, responding to the latest discoveries in physics and astronomy, and adopting a green mandate. He holds Echo Faith Worship at Botanic Park, Speaker's Corner, in Adelaide on Sundays at 10:30. The website is scotschurch.org.au. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, which tries to be ecologically conscious, although I don't know if we succeed on the practical level. If it's not translated into practical measures that minimize harm, then what good is all the rhetoric? The Uniting Church is trying to put its money where its mouth is. So to that end, we go now to the Maroubra Junction Uniting Church in Sydney, where I met Jeff Callahan and Miriam Pepper. Jeff actually coordinated Project Green Church until about 3 weeks ago, when he handed over responsibilities to Miriam. So I walked with them to Exhibit A, a brightly painted water tank.
Well, Jeff, that looks like a mighty beautiful water tank. I've never seen one like it.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm glad you appreciate it. Just to give you a bit of background about the water tank, It's a 5,000-litre water tank that is hooked up to our preschool toilets, services the toilets. It also irrigates our lawns and our garden. We've got a very generous discount for installing this water tank of $2,000 from our local council and $550 from Sydney Water, which made it very affordable in the end. And when we installed the water tank, we affectionately nicknamed it Delilah and realised that Delilah was kind of homely, wasn't very attractive, so we thought we'd beautify her with a mural. So interesting story behind that is that one night I was watching Compass on the ABC. I love my ABC. And they had a story on a guy named Mystery, who's a hip-hop artist and graffiti artist from the inner west of Sydney. And he was doing some really good work for churches. He himself is a committed Christian. And so I ended up getting in touch with him through Compass, asked him to come out and do something for us, and this was the result. So that's the woman of the well. And there's some obvious, very obvious symbology behind that in terms of the well, but maybe Miriam would be best placed to explain the actual theology and why we chose the woman of the well for our particular water tank.
Yeah, the woman at the well is really important for us at Maroubra Junction, not only highlighting the importance of water for us all to live and so on, but also that the story is about Jesus meeting a Samaritan woman at the well. And not only are Jews not supposed to associate with Samaritans, but also this woman is ostracized by her own community. She's a woman of ill repute, having had many husbands and her current man not being her husband. Jesus talks to her and asks her to draw him some water. And they have a discussion about how the water that he offers is living water, water where people won't go thirsty. But the point is that Jesus has made contact with a social outcast. So it highlights for us the importance to what we do here at Maroubra Junction of social justice. And we would see ecological justice and ecological issues as linking together with those social justice issues. So it's a great story to have painted on our water tank that draws together our theology and the kind of ministry we try to do with our care for the environment.
Miriam, you were actually involved in something called Christian Ecology Link in the UK. What is that? And do we have one here?
Christian Ecology Link is a non-denominational grassroots organisation that is about caring for the environment, and they seek to encourage and inspire Christians, churches, church organisations to do likewise through a variety of programs, looking at lifestyle change, looking at trying to green their churches, encouraging people to get involved in campaigning in relation to climate and so on, looking at issues of food, of biodiversity, a wide, wide range of issues that they look at. It's been running for about 25 years. I think it's its 25-year anniversary just this month, actually. I think they had a celebration. We don't have such a thing here in Australia, although for my several years over there, there might be new developments that I'm not aware about. But I certainly think it's a wonderful model of people coming together from all different sorts of denominations of churches, different theological persuasions, if you like, who can all unite in a common goal to protect the environment in all the many diverse ways that that can happen.
Well, Jeff, it sounds like Miriam was the perfect recruit to take over from your job as the coordinator of Project Green.
Yeah, I mean, call it God's will, the Holy Spirit working through us. It is really amazing. We're really fortunate, and I actually just started a new job that it probably sort of tacks on to that last question you asked about setting up an interfaith response to climate change here in Australia. So I've been taken on in a role to help try and coordinate that. I've been fortunate enough now to be able to sort of expand this vision of, you know, faith being having a response to climate change on a broader scale, and now Miriam can sort of help in this micro level as well. So, and we can still interact on that at the same time. So it's a really good opportunity. It's fabulous.
Well, one of the problems down here in Maroubra is the carbon dioxide emissions from the planes going overhead constantly.
That's true.
It certainly underlines the importance of having an ecological response.
Yeah, you've got that busy highway just out there as well, so yeah.
Well, show me what else you've got here that was put up. What, as a consequence of Project Green?
Yeah, as a consequence of Project Green, which I'm not sure if Pete explained to you or not, but just resulted of just a few friends sitting around and trying to work out, you know, what can we do for the environment, feeling frustrated that we could, as individuals, we couldn't really do much. So, but as a church community, perhaps we could do more. So we thought, yeah, let's green up our church, and then let's try and inspire other churches to green up as well. And so that's how it all started. And then we just keep coming up with imaginative and inspiring ways to do that in our own church. So the car share program, which I'll show you now if you like, was one of those initiatives. So this is our car share car, affectionately named Julia. The car share program is an initiative that we started up in collaboration with our local council, Randwick Council, who have been very supportive for a number of our initiatives, and a company called Go Get Car Share, who have these cars distributed throughout Sydney, and they wanted to set up in the eastern suburbs. But in order to do that, they need someone in the local community who's willing to provide a space and also provide initial incentive in terms of, you know, a certain amount of people that will use it, a certain amount of money that will be contributed towards it being set up in the area. So, yeah, we agreed to help them do that. So
how does it work? I mean, who gets to use this?
Everyone in our church can use it, and anyone in the broader community, anyone in Maroubra can do it. So it's this idea that, you know, not only our church is having a shared resource, but we're sharing that resource with the broader community as well.
Gosh, I think cars have to be the last frontier. I mean, around here, I see about 50 cars right now in my vision.
Yeah.
I think cars are probably going to be the hardest thing to get Sydneysiders to change their attitude
I agree. Like, Australian society in general is just addicted to cars. But I think we've got this mission, or what would you call it? The thing we call reclaiming our skills for the post-oil era. And as resources become more and more scarce, things like car sharing are going to have become more and more important. And we're getting in early, basically. And Miriam and I, for example, we also ride our bicycles wherever we can, and we have a cycle club here at Maroubra Junction. So we're lowering our carbon footprint by sharing a car, but we're also sharing a resource with the community, which is a very Christian very Christian thing to do, which is inspired by Paul the Apostle. But maybe Miriam could tell you probably a bit more about that.
Miriam, is the idea to get all of the uniting churches to get behind this to the extent that, how significant would it be in terms of reducing the impact on the environment?
There's a whole diversity of things that people can do in their own churches to address issues of climate and issues of ecology more generally. I think Jeff has done a calculation of how much carbon dioxide can be saved just by the uniting churches in Australia switching to green power. And Jeff, I think, knows the figure off the top of his head.
Yeah, I can tell you, actually, because we realise that as one church switching to green power, we can achieve a little bit. But if we can get all churches in New South Wales, of which there are 655, to switch to green power, you know, we'd be saving up to 4,500 tonnes of CO2 a year, which is equivalent to taking 1,000 cars off the road. So, and that's just the churches in New South Wales. So that proposal got passed, and the Uniting Church of New South Wales has committed to switching to 100% green power. And then at the next National Assembly, we're hoping that the churches nationwide will take up that call, and then hopefully other denominations as well.
Miriam, it sounds like you've got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, definitely, especially when we think that it's not only things like switching to green power that we're trying to encourage people to do, but also to share our story here about how you can build community at the same time as trying to address issues of the environment. So the car share scheme is a case in point, sharing resources and learning to live together as people cooperating, as in some ways a different way of doing things than we may have been brought up to do, and so on. So thinking about the diversity of what's possible and just the things we've shown you so far, a small part of what we're doing, there's a huge range of initiatives to encourage different churches to take up and to consider their own local context and what's appropriate.
So what do you actually do? You go to churches and tell them, look, put in, you know, solar panels here, a water tank there?
Mm-hmm. I started last week, so that's a question I'll be able to answer more and more in the future. But certainly it will involve things like visiting churches, showing them what we've done here and how it would be possible to do that in their context, running workshops for people to come to and see what we've done, working through the channels of church structures, as Jeff was talking about in relation to green power, encouraging churches to link up with their councils. Our council has been very supportive, as Jeff said. And seeing what else is around there in their communities. And certainly the different things that we've done here, and there's a wide spectrum of those things, we can show that as an example. And we also have a website and a Facebook group. We're making use of that facility to try and share share some of the initiatives that we've got here and encourage others to learn lessons from the things we've done as well.
Yeah, so just to, as you're saying, how are we actually trying to spread the message? A good example of that is I gave a presentation on our Project Green Church here at our church to Blaxland Uniting Church up in the Blue Mountains. And as a result of giving that presentation, they formed an environmental committee at their church. They've switched to green power. And one congregant has also generously donated enough money to have their own solar panels installed at the church. And they're also going to be lobbying their government, the local government and their MP, to have subsidies for churches for green power. So I think that's a great example of this, the infectiousness of this story and this idea that from little things, big things can grow. So this green wave spreading out across Australia, hopefully.
Another one as well is that another church in the eastern suburbs called Grace Point Church has been involved in Clean Up Australia Day. And so we were involved with them. We had a stall at Clean Up Australia Day. So we've made good contacts with that church. And the intention is that they'll assist us in our area to do something similar at Maroubra Beach. So it's again, it's linking up with different churches in different contexts about the things in their localities that they can do, and often in ways that aren't planned possibly as well, but more spontaneous ways that appeal to people.
So this is really more like a green network as opposed to a green project. Jeff, you've recently become the Faith and Climate Officer at the Climate Institute, which has to be the most unusual job description, I'm sure. Yeah. Did you seek them out or did they seek you out?
They had that was the job description on the internet, and a friend of mine just referred me to it because, I mean, I've been doing a lot of work here at the church, and a lot of it is volunteer, and it wasn't paying the bills, unfortunately. So when I saw this job opportunity to get paid to do something that I love doing and that I had been doing for a year already, it was just a perfect opportunity, yeah.
Isn't your background Catholic?
Yes, right. I grew up Catholic. Yeah, I grew up Catholic, and interestingly, I've also studied Chinese medicine, so I have a good insight into Eastern philosophies as well, which I really enjoy.
How do you think the other churches, like the Catholic Church, is doing on this issue?
Well, interestingly, on that point, the Vatican has just committed to being carbon neutral, which I think is the first sovereign state in the world to be carbon neutral. They're going to offset their carbon emissions by sponsoring a forest, I think, in Hungary. And I think that's a great example to Catholics around the world. There are examples as well in Sydney. There's the Columbans with the Faith Ecology Network. They're doing a lot of interfaith work and trying to promote awareness within their own religion. But also, for me, like, climate change has this amazing potential to unite all religions in this common cause and recognise our similarities, our commonality.
Jeff, I understand that one of the most downloaded documents from the Climate Institute is the document called Common Belief, which is a kind of collection of statements by faith communities on climate change. Did that have anything to do with your involvement in the Climate Institute?
Well, basically the Climate Institute realised that the broader community is really looking for some leadership from religious communities on the issues of climate change. And so, yeah, that's what basically inspired them to actively engage someone in that role to help try and coordinate the faith-based response to climate change. And as I understand it, it is a very unique role. It's the first time in Australia that such a role has been created. So I'm really excited. It's a really exciting opportunity. Yeah.
Is it a limited kind of project, 5 years, 10 years?
Yeah, initially it's just for half a year, but they're hoping that it will branch into something that will continue after that. Because being an NGO, they only have limited funding, but after that, hopefully, we'll find other funding and ways to continue the work.
Who does fund the Climate Institute?
A guy named Mark Wooten. He's a farmer from Victoria. He originally was a climate skeptic who was experiencing the worst of the drought. He basically tried to drought-proof his farm as much as possible and then just came to the realisation that climate change is a real issue, and he decided to donate $10 million of his of money that he inherited to the Climate Institute to try and help raise awareness about climate change in the broader community.
Pretty wonderful. I guess we need a lot more people like him.
Yeah, I believe it's the second largest philanthropic donation in Australia. So, yeah, it's very generous. And, yeah, as a result, there's some people doing some really good work and helping raise awareness about climate change because of his donation. So,
well, I think I should thank you both for raising awareness about climate change.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Miriam Pepper is the outreach officer with Project Green Church, which encourages the uniting churches in Sydney and elsewhere to go green. Jeff Callaghan is the Faith and Climate Officer for the Climate Institute of Australia in Sydney. To find out more about what's going on at Maroubra Junction Uniting Church and its Green Project, and for a link to the Common Belief document, just go to our website at abc.net.au/religion and click the Spirit of Things. And while you're there, you can also download this program as an MP3 file or just trawl through our recent programs, which you can hear online.
And right at this moment now, five policemen have climbed onto the shore behind the three protesters who are sitting right in front of me. Now there's more police arriving. We have now a total of nine police.
Can I have your attention for a minute? The land you are on is under the control of the Hydroelectric Commission, and you are trespassing on that land. The hydro representative has requested my assistance to remove you from their land. If you do not move immediately, you will be arrested. There is any reason why you cannot be moved.
We believe we have the right to be here because we think it should be a national park.
You're under arrest. You're under arrest. You're under arrest.
Right now, the three protesters, the first arrests of this blockade day here in the southwest of Tasmania. Right now, they're being escorted by the police over some rather treacherous rocks onto a police craft.
Arrests being made at the Franklin Dam protests in southwest Tasmania, December 1982. When you think about it, our current attitude to the environment is not that different from the Bible's. In Genesis, God creates the earth, the waters, the heavens, the creatures, and declares them all good. Well, what does that mean for us? It's one of the ways in which Peter Hobson, the minister of the Uniting Church in Maroubra Junction, thinks about his Christian faith and his commitment to the environment. I was interested in hearing his perspective on Project Green Church. Peter, welcome to the Spirit of Things.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it's actually good for me to be here in this church in Maroubra, where you are the minister. But you're also a chaplain at the University of New South Wales, and I imagine amongst students, climate change and issues of the environment are really popular.
Yes, it's something that students feel very strongly about. It's an issue that not only engages with their passions of wanting to see the world to be a place that is more just, but it's something that they feel they can actually have a positive contribution towards, something they can engage with, something that they can actually cause change, which is very encouraging for young people.
Have students seen climate change as an issue that naturally links with Christian faith?
For the students I work with, I think it's their commitment to Christianity that opens their eyes to see that the world that they live in, the privileged world they live in here in Australia, has consequences for other people. And so as an outworking of their faith, as wanting to see their discipleship as something that can change the world to be a better place, they see working for issues such as environmental responsibility as something that they can be a part of, that they can actually contribute towards. And they see that it's something that's not just captured by their Christian faith. So as Christians working to change the environment, to be more responsible about environmental issues, they're actually helping sisters and brothers of other faiths or people who don't claim to have a faith at all.
So Christian students at the University of New South Wales are using climate change as a bridge to other faith communities?
Oh, for sure, for sure. And when I say Christians at University of New South Wales, there's many different Christian groups there. And the Christian group I work with is quite small, Christian Students Uniting. It's an ecumenical group. But we see issues as a way of engaging with people. On a campus, university campus, to talk about issues of faith can seem to belong to a certain marketplace of ideas, But to talk about issues of justice or the environment, it's something that people who may not be interested about faith, the environment is something that we all share. And we've been very surprised that when you talk about issues of justice or in particular the environment, and you say that you do so from a faith perspective, suddenly that faith conversation can open up because of that.
And do you therefore hold Bible study sessions that actually try to read the Bible as an ecological text?
Sure. I just had a similar conversation a few minutes ago with someone. To date, I don't think you could say we've had a particular ecological hermeneutic as we looked at biblical texts, but the hermeneutic we do have is one that always engages with issues of justice.
Can I just say hermeneutic as a method of interpreting the Bible?
Yes. So, for example, if we were looking at the story of creation, it'd probably be fair to say in some ways of approaching that text, the argument tends to be around creation science versus evolution, whereas that sort of approach can be quite problematic, and it raises a whole heap of questions that take you off on tangents that even if you think you come to an answer, don't actually solve any of the problems to begin with. But if we actually take an approach that looks at the story of creation, what does it mean for God to say that this thing's good? What does it mean for God to delight in creation? And then how is our response to creation, this wonderful gift that God has given to humankind, how are we to respond to that which is good? If that becomes the hermeneutical tool that we use, if that becomes outlines the approach that we take to the text, then a whole array of different possibilities arise from that. If we see that as image bearers of the divine, as human beings made in God's image, that we are to be caretakers of God's good gift, then things like clearing forests and polluting the atmosphere, they become responses to how we understand our own humanity. So if we are image bearers of the divine and we're doing these destructive things, then I'm not sure we're being the people that God has created us to be.
So this is another example of how the Bible can be read as a radical document, as an invitation to a more radical position in society, as opposed to being a conservative person, conserving the way things are.
Oh, for sure. It'd be fair to say that the theological approach we use at the university is, in Australia, is often referred to as radical discipleship. And, you know, it shouldn't be confused with fundamentalism. We're not suggesting the Bible should be literally interpreted, but it should be literary. It should have a literary interpretation, that the story, the narrative of God's engaging with the world is one that we should take very seriously. And it is very radical in terms of being at the root or the fundamental core of how we understand ourselves. So with that approach, our understanding of politics, ethics, faith, life is very informed by the biblical text. And how we then relate to the issues of the environment comes from that core understanding that it comes to us from the biblical stories.
Radical positions appeal to students on university campuses, but how about here in Maroubra, a seaside suburb in the southern edge of Sydney? How does a message like this appeal to your congregation? What's it like here?
Yes, Rachel, it's a unique congregation we have here. Maroubra Junction Uniting, where we are, Maroubra it has the highest density public housing in all of Australia. And as well as that, we're on the sort of what I call the yuppie fringe that extends south from, say, the Coogee area. So the land prices here, as with all of Sydney, I guess, are quite high, but they're feeling that pressure a bit more and more as it all moves south. Because we're not too far from the jail, I think that's sort of kept some of the more expensive development a little bit at bay. But the demographic of our congregation, we have uni students and recent grads, but we also have retirees and people who certainly wouldn't be considered affluent by any means. On a service on any given Sunday, we could have people coming in off the street, homeless people, or certainly people who don't have a university education. And so on a Sunday service, we can be talking about the radical nature of the gospel. We can be looking at a very intellectual level the demands that the gospel text places upon us. But it also means that we need to be real about the community of which we're a part. And part of the, I guess, the emphasis of an understanding of radical discipleship is based in a very mature and very authentic understanding of what community is. When Paul talks in Scripture about the body of Christ having different members, we take that very seriously. So whereas a part of our congregation may be very interested in some of the hermeneutical understandings of the text, other members of our congregation would be much more interested in trying to get encouragement for where their next meal's coming from. And so as a congregation, we rally around the fact that Christ has called us together, and we work out what that looks like as we go. So for issues of the environment, we'll have some members of our congregation who are enthusiastic supporters of the Greens parties, and we'll have other members of our congregation who are enthusiastic supporters of the conservative side of politics. But it's not the party politics that defines what we're about. It's the message of Christ. And so the challenge for us as a congregation is to realise, how do we look after God's good earth? How do we share a message of reconciliation and forgiveness and love and justice amongst us as a community that holds different ideas together but holds the one ideal of the kingdom of God as a thing that unites us?
The kingdom of God is a green image. That's quite alluring. Can I ask you finally whether the attitude to ecological issues is determined by the generation that you're in? I mean, is it a young project, or do people who are older, particularly older unemployed, are they attracted at all to this?
The enthusiasm has definitely come from the younger generation, but I think it's one of those issues that does transcend. I think one of the things we've seen is older generations have a feeling of responsibility for perhaps some of the situations that they've helped to create. It'd be fair to say that some of the older generation too may have a bit more scepticism towards some of the environmental rhetoric that is used. But that can be really healthy. I think one of the gifts our congregation is that it's not just university students. So there are older people and there are children as well. So the students find themselves in a wider church family that helps to mediate their passions and enthusiasm about particular ideas, and this one, environmental issues as well. Having said that, I think the older people appreciate, I think they learn more about the environment from the younger people in the congregation than they do from media releases or the politics of the day. And one of the challenges for us as a church is to find entry points for people. So there'll be some people in our congregation who will be very active in terms of lobbying political parties about environmental issues. And there'll be other people in the congregation who are happy to mow someone's lawn using an eco-mower, which is a battery-operated mower, so it's not using greenhouse gases. And it's actually, by using a lawnmower, though, to do that, we're actually mowing the lawns of elderly people or people who don't have the finances or the resources to get their own lawn mowed. So we're actually serving the community and using it as a way to witness in terms of environmental issues as well. So we start from there, ranging through to encouraging people to change their light bulbs. I mean, we're trying to look for as many different entry points in this whole scheme as we can, realising that a lot of these entry points are also full of compromise. One of the things we wrestle with as Christians in the community is, how do we live out our faith in a way that's authentic, but realising that just about every action of discipleship is going to be an action of compromise somewhere, and having to work out what those compromises are we can live with and what are the ones that perhaps we need to avoid. And as a community, we work that out together by the mistakes we make as much as by the successes we feel we have.
Well, it sounds like you've really balanced the ideal and the practical and the real, so you probably have a good future. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Rachel.
The minister of the Uniting Church at Maroubra Junction, Peter Hobson, one of the people leading the new wave of Echo Ministry. Of course, the future is ours to hand on to the little children, so I went round the back of the church to the preschool with Miriam Pepper and Jeff Callahan to see whether Project Green Church had included them.
Well, Miriam and Jeffrey, here are the kids at the play school, and they're playing on AstroTurf. Why not grass?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I think it's been a trend in recent years for children's playing equipment to use more artificial surfaces rather than natural surfaces. I mean, it would be my hope for the future that all of us, our children, and us who are already grown up as well, that we start to appreciate more our connections with the natural world, how dependent we are on the natural world, and to enjoy playing and digging in the dirt and so on. Even me, myself, I love to cycle in the rain, for example. So I hope that we can move towards, through food growing, through playing outside, through experience the natural world, we can move towards seeing the connections that we have with our planet.
This week's program was produced by the Little Green People, Jeff Wood and me. And the sound engineering was by Roy Huberman, who I'm not sure is green. Music today was by Queensland group Sacred Earth, and they definitely are green, and Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody and the Tittas. Next week, the Spiritual Classic series is returning with the popular and playful Zen Flesh, Zen Bones and Carl Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections. So time to top up your knowledge if you never got around to reading those inspirational classics. Next week on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.